Welcome back to CKUT on 90.3 FM in Montreal. We're now joined live by phone by Jules Boykoff, who is a former Olympian athlete and current associate professor at Pacific University in Oregon, and the author of the book Celebration Capitalism and the Olympic Games. We're also joined by Amélie Philipson, who will be interviewing him.
Hi, Jules.
Hello.
So you wrote a book called Celebration Capitalism and the Olympic Games. What is celebration capitalism, and what does it have to do with the Olympics?
Sure. Well, I think the place to start with celebration capitalism is actually Naomi Klein's Disaster Capitalism. In her really great book, The Shock Doctrine and the Rise of Disaster Capitalism, she talks about how capitalists tend to capitalize off catastrophe. So when there's a tsunami or a sharp economic downturn or something like that, we see capitalists swoop in and institute neoliberal principles, meaning privatizing everything with a pulse, getting rid of regulations, so deregulating, and using free market rhetoric like let the market decide. And so what I argue in that book you mentioned, Celebration Capitalism and the Olympic Games, is that actually capitalism is a nimble shapeshifter, and sometimes it takes the form of Naomi Klein's disaster capitalism, but at other times it takes the form of celebration capitalism, which is not rooted in these ideas of neoliberal capitalism, strictly speaking, but rather it's in the ideas of public-private partnerships where actually the state plays a major role in what happens. It's not like under neoliberalism how the state kind of hands things over to private companies. The state actually plays a major role in organizing under celebration capitalism. And the Olympics are a perfect example of that because you see these incredibly lopsided public-private partnerships to fund the Olympic Games, whether they're in Vancouver, whether they're in London, or whether they're in Sochi. And that's just indicative of this larger structure, this larger formation of capitalism.
What kind of action can people take to resist it?
Well, there's all sorts of actions. I mean, you don't have to look too far in Canada. Just look across the way to Vancouver, and you saw some really spirited, principled activism that rose up to challenge this sort of huge Olympic juggernaut when it rolled into town. And you saw people across the political spectrum organizing against it. You saw the seizure of space down on West Hastings Avenue, the creation of an Olympic tent village that was designed to get people housing and raise questions around housing in Vancouver, right there in the downtown east side, and it was successful in placing numerous people, dozens of people, in housing who didn't have it before. So, I mean, I guess the way to combat celebration capitalism, I say, is to protest early and protest often. In fact, if your city's thinking about hosting the bid, like Toronto has, like numerous times, not too far from you all, you get out in the streets and you say, hey, what's this going to actually bring us? And that tends to be the way to fend off celebration capitalism from invading your own host city or your own city.
You've previously said in interviews that you don't find athlete boycott to be very effective. Why not?
Well, I would say just based on history, if you look at the biggest boycotts from the history of the Olympic Games, you look at 1980, 1984, where the United States and the Soviet Union put on their respective boycotts. What did that actually do for people on the ground? The United States boycotted the Moscow Games because of what was going on with the invasion of Afghanistan. Did that help that situation at all? Probably not, actually. In fact, what it did was it prevented athletes from going and participating in the Games, and that was the biggest effect. One of the reasons why I am opposed to an athlete boycott is because I feel like it undercuts the possibility of principled, creative athlete activism. After all, if you think back to 1968, that iconic moment of world history when John Carlos and Tommy Smith thrust their black gloved fists into the Mexico City sky as they stood on the medal stand and listened to the U.S. national anthem, that would have never happened if they would have boycotted those Olympics. And let me tell you, there was a lot of talk from athletes about boycotting those games. In fact, if you look at Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was then known as Lew Alcindor, he's a great basketball player, and he decided not to attend those Olympics. He kind of did his own private boycott of the games. And do we talk about Kareem Abdul-Jabbar when we think of 1968? No, we don't. But we do talk a lot about John Carlos, Tommy Smith, Peter Norman, who was the Australian also on the medal stand, and their incredibly courageous act of political dissent. Now, where I do support an idea of a boycott is for people who are thinking about being sport tourists and heading and watching the Olympics, the kind of Olympic mavens who travel the earth in order to watch the games wherever they go. if I'm one of them, I think to myself, do I really want to bring my hard currency, bring my money over to a place that so thoroughgoingly discriminates against LGBT people? Do I want to go to a place where dissent is routinely squelched, where it's actually baked into the laws of the country that make it incredibly difficult to express political dissent against Vladimir Putin and his government? So, no, in that case, I would say that I support a boycott, but of a specific type, of a sport tourist-type boycott.
Pussy Riot were detained in Sochi for several hours this morning. They were pardoned by the Kremlin and let out of prison just before the Olympics. Do you think this tendency to play around between human rights and public relations is specific to Russia, or is it something we can see at any Olympics?
I would say it's not specific to Russia. In fact, if you look back at the previous Olympics, which were in London in 2012, the day of the opening ceremonies, when Danny Boyle was having his big panegyric to the National Health Service inside the stadium, outside more than 180 critical mass activists were kettled, rounded up, and arrested. And so that happened on the night of the opening ceremonies in London. So this is something that happens across political spaces when it comes to the Olympic Games. And that's an element, I would say, of celebration capitalism, is that you get these incredibly bulked up police forces, local police forces and national police forces. They get all the weapons they always wanted, and their goal is to basically squelch anybody who wants to put a cramp in the fun, a cramp in the celebration. So, you know, you have all these local police forces who've racked up all these different weapons, including sometimes military-grade weapons, in the name of fighting terrorism. Well, when the terrorists don't come, guess who's sitting right there? The activists. And so when we see what's going on in Russia, it's indicative of a bigger pattern. Now, Russia, in advance of the Olympics, passed a whole slate of laws that make it quite easy for the authorities there to suppress political activism. They passed a law that said if you accepted money from a foreign entity, you had to register as, quote, a foreign agent, which echoes negatively with the history of the Soviet Union. They passed a capacious law regarding the definition of high treason, which you could have basically apply to almost anybody. And so, you know, because of that, and because of the fact that they set up so-called protest zones specific for people to act in of about 17 kilometers from the nearest Olympic site, we haven't seen as much activism in Russia, although we have seen a spate of it today over the last couple of days with the Pussy Riot case that you mentioned.
Could you specifically talk about gay rights at the Sochi Olympics?
Sure. Well, I mean, in advance of the Olympics, the Russian Duma passed a law that made it illegal to put forth what they call propaganda that put LGBT gay life in a positive way. They framed it so that you couldn't talk about LGBT issues to people under the age of 18, which sort of leads to the false equation of homosexuality and pedophilia, which President Putin himself has sort of encouraged, that false connection. And Putin signed it into law last summer. And it's really raised a lot of questions about the integrity of the Olympic movement, because if you look at the fundamental principles of Olympism that are baked right into the Olympic Charter. If you look at those fundamental principles of Olympism, they talk about not being able to discriminate against anybody based on politics, based on religion, based on gender, and that sort of thing. And so this law flies in the face of the Olympic Charter. And what has the International Olympic Committee done? Virtually nothing. And it's kind of been a real wake-up call for a lot of people that the International Olympic Committee is willing to step aside and not really take strong action when it's not convenient to do so.
What do you think of the media coverage of the Olympics at Sochi so far? Do you think it's been here in North America especially harsh because Russia is a country that North Americans love to hate, or is it legitimate?
I do think it has been a little bit harsh for the reason you just said. Putin's a really easy target for the West, and so you've seen a stream of anti-Putin-type coverage. On the other hand, Putin and the Duma deserve a lot of critical attention because of some of the laws that I've talked about just in the last few minutes. But it makes it easy for Putin to basically use the West as a foil domestically to say, ah, see, look, they're totally against me. And that kind of plays well for him domestically. I mean, in terms of my assessment of the overall coverage, I would say I've seen some really good coverage from particular journalists of issues around Sochi. I guess I could go for a little bit less coverage of the poor journalists who are getting sort of yellowish, brownish water coming out at their hotels, and more coverage of the cities and villages around Sochi that have to live with that every day, or at least if you're going to talk about, if you're a journalist and you're going to talk about that dirty water in your own sink, you at least use it as a springboard to talk about some of these other outlying communities who are suffering in a major way because of the Olympics.
When and why have the Olympics started to use the idea of being environmentally friendly?
Well, it really started in the 1990s astride the Rio Conference of 1992, and the Olympics began to fold in this idea of environmental and social sustainability into its rhetoric. And so what it did was it created this thing called Agenda 21 that outlined what the International Olympic Committee wanted to do in regards to sustainability. And in fact, it made sustainability and environmental issues the third pillar of Olympism, along with sport and culture. And that all sounds great. If you just read the documents, it sounds really good. Like, and nowadays, every single Olympics that comes along has to sort of obligatorily claim that it's the, quote, greenest games to date. But if you look a little bit more carefully at what the Olympics are actually accomplishing in terms of environmental success and improvement, it gets a little bit less convincing, shall we say. In fact, a lot of critics have argued that the Olympics are basically engaging in a form of greenwashing. Let me give a specific example of why an activist might come along and say that. I mean, in 2012 at the London Summer Olympics, the organizers decided that they were going to come up with something new, a corporate partnership program called the Sustainability Partners Program. That Sustainability Partners Program had six companies in it, including BMW, the car manufacturer, as well as EDF Energy, which is a huge pusher of nuclear power, especially in Europe. It had General Electric on the list. And kind of amazingly, it also had BP, the oil company. They were a sustainability partner of the 2012 Olympics, a mere 2 years after the incredible devastation that BP unleashed on the Gulf of Mexico with the huge oil spill that happened there. And so, you know, that told a lot of people that these programs really aren't that serious. And in fact, there was a commission for the that was supposed to assess the sustainability practices of London, and they came out with a report at the end of the games that said, hey, you know, basically admitting, hey, these companies, they don't really do anything in terms of sustainability. It's essentially a pay-to-play game, and BP paid, and they get to play, and they get to tell everybody that how green they are, even when that's not the case. Just this past year, there was a company in Toronto that put out a list of the 100 most greenest corporations around the planet. And of those 100 firms, only one of them was a sustainability partner at London, and that was Cisco. And so it kind of just points to the critique that activists have long leveled, that the games are sort of a conveyor belt of greenwashing.
What about Sochi? How green are these Olympics?
Sochi's been a bit of a disaster when it comes to environmental issues. They basically paved over a huge natural space. There's all these illegal dumps that include toxic substances, even though that wasn't supposed to be the case. A bunch of pristine lands have been degraded in order to build on top of them. There's certain communities that I mentioned before that haven't had clean water, thanks to the Olympics rolling through their town, that have kind of cut off their access to the main roads because of the Sochi building. Meanwhile, Sochi organizers talk about how Dow Chemicals is going to be helping them become more and more green. They gave an award to Coca-Cola for their efforts to make the Olympics more green. But you don't have to look too hard around the Sochi area to find people who are very disgruntled by this. And, you know, you've also seen a pretty serious crackdown carried out against environmental activists in the Sochi area. There's a particular activist named Evgeny Vitishko who's gotten a lot of media coverage lately. He was arrested a little while back for spray painting a fence, and then was subsequently arrested right before the Olympics started, supposedly for swearing at a bus stop, which constitutes, under Russian law, petty hooliganism. And he was stored in jail for 15 days through the beginning of the Olympics and then sent off to prison. So, I mean, there's been a real crackdown aimed at environmental activists who are on the ground in Russia who have been raising the questions that we've just been talking about.
Some people have compared the Sochi Olympics to the 1936 German Olympics. Do you think this is a hyperbolic reaction?
Well, I mean, I guess I don't know how far you can take that, and I would be really hesitant to compare anybody to Hitler, who was in charge in 1936 when the Olympics went to Berlin. The similarities, I suppose, you could say are that the International Olympic Committee have made a decision that is controversial and quite in conflict with their own Olympic principles, and also that there was talk before both the 1936 Olympics and the current Olympics in Sochi to engage in a boycott, neither of which was overly successful. But I mean, it's sort of a tired comparison to set up anybody to look in comparative lens with Hitler. But I suppose most Olympics, in a lot of ways, are used as propaganda value by the leaders of their countries. So that certainly was the case in 1936 in Berlin. In fact, organizers of the 1936 Olympics were the people who came up with the idea of the torch relay, where you run the Olympic torch around the country before the game starts to sort of rally up public support for the game. That was a creation of Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister under Adolf Hitler. In fact, Hitler wasn't even all that keen on using the Olympics to his advantage until Goebbels told him of the immense propaganda value of the games. And we've certainly seen Putin use the Olympics for similar sort of propaganda value. But hey, David Cameron did the same thing in London. And we saw leaders across Vancouver and British Columbia do the same during the 2010 Olympics. So, if you're an elected leader, you're going to do your best to bask in the Olympic glow and get the most you can out of it politically.
Jules, thank you very much. That's all we have time for.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.